just said about adenosine, ATP being just like coltan that all of my darlings have in their cell phone while they look the other way about the 10 million bodies they're dancing around. The elephant is headless corpses in the middle under the rug that you sweep all this under the rug with. That's a mountain of dirt to be dancing around. Okay, now the head of the elephant is being pranced around by these Republicans.
Be able to live for free forever.
Old Abe Lincoln never died. He's in here with me, darling.
Oh my God, dude, you shouldn't resent having to work. That's really sad.
Anyway, caffeine blocks the slowing down of your sleepy system. So as the ATP, the adenosine piles up, it's a byproduct. You got these three adenosine triphosphate. You have three phosphates that are hooked on where hydrogen could just as easily sit. So as these phosphates get kicked off, there's all this energy that the plant started doing. We've got the same. Now, caffeine takes the place of the adenosine. So as the adenosine piles up in the blood, there's these receptors that said, oh man, you got all this waste product. You got to get your phosphates back on your adenosine. And so you got to rest while that happens because, you know, maybe energy processing. You got to cut that to zero so you can recharge your ATP. So your battery's got to charge overnight, dig. And the plant's got the same thing, except they produce it when the sun comes out. And we do it when we eat the plants, for example. Unless you're a corpse eater, and I won't even talk about that. I don't puke on the mic. So the slime buckets are the same. They're still pushing, it's 3-quinucleodienyl benzylate. So you got a couple of benzene rings, and there's this little cross section. It looks like four corners where the crosshairs are centered on the indigenous world. Never mind. So it's got a carbon there with four links, and one of them goes to an OH. And the other one goes to, it must be another carbon because one of the bonds is double to an O and the other is going to an oxygen, and that's what the nitrogen little thing is hanging off of. So anyway, whatever that is, they call it BZ in NATO, okay? And it's what the Swiss lab, and in April, the Russian foreign minister said, well, you go talk to the Swiss. They tested it, and it's this low lethality. It takes 400 times an incapacitating dosage to kill you. That's why the Skripals are still alive, okay? And so let's call it Skripal BZ, that the zombie MSM stooges are pushing as Novichok, which is the same organophosphates that I'll get to back. I'm going to sample some from previous episodes of horror, but let me just get back to the. And Daniel Ortega was democratically elected, and then
those that were put in positions of authority and leadership. I was just called crazy.
We are viewing the remake of Bridge Over the River Kwai about the British POWs trying to save their bridge working in POWs under them
for 16 hours, but I thought even you are not that stupid.
Well, no, you were wrong.
We want Nelson Mandela and the people of South Africa to know that we will stand shoulder to shoulder, hip to hip, until apartheid is eradicated. Sisters and brothers, it is fascinating, it is historic, it is symbolic that this son of Africa comes at this moment to remind us of the unfinished business of ending apartheid in South Africa and racism in America. Sexism in America. All forms of chauvinism in America. Let us welcome this extraordinary, beautiful black African man, one with the courage to turn to his enemy and say, forget the past, let us march to the future. Let's negotiate a new South Africa. Let us welcome this beautiful black man with unwavering integrity, incredible principle, unwavering courage, no fear. Let us welcome a man that makes us all feel somewhat taller, a hell of a lot stronger, and a whole lot more proud. Bay Area, let us welcome Nelson Mandela!
Yeah.
context of the Persian Gulf War would be catastrophic and totally unacceptable. There may be other members of Congress who come to a different conclusion, but that is a political statement, and those issues get resolved in an open and honest and tough debate on the floor of the United States Congress. But what we're saying in this lawsuit is that procedurally, the process that is granted to us under the Constitution of the United States gives Congress that authority.
Maybe I should jump to the... I put it on Facebook. Apologies for that, but it works, so here we go. I just click on myself, and here I am. Okay, so, yes, Ronald Dellums. Cause of action was denial of his constitutional right as a member of Congress to vote on the question of war on Nicaragua. The information plaintiffs provided the Attorney General's was, this is in quotes, much more than mere generalized allegations of wrongdoing, unquote. Without factual support, plaintiffs gave the Attorney General pages of name, dates, and times and places in support of the claim that federal officials sponsored paramilitary expeditions against Nicaragua in violation of the Neutrality Act, all as more fully detailed at page 1492. Super. Oh, that's a coincidence. The court finds the Attorney General's conclusion that the information provided by the plaintiffs was not, quote, specific information of a federal offense, unquote, sufficient to constitute grounds to investigate, unquote, to be unreasonable and wholly unsupported by the record. Consequently, the court must set aside the Attorney General's determination and accompanying failure to act as unlawful, 5 U.S.C. Section 706, subsection 2, CEG Washington State Farm Bureau versus Marshall, 625 F2D 296 302, 9th Circuit, 1980. The 1505 law requires the court to compel agency action unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed, 5 U.S.C. Section 706. I remember quoting that in Getty versus Casey, subsection 1. Environmental Defense Fund Incorporated versus Costal, 657 F2D 275 283. D.C. Circuit, 1981. Plaintiffs are entitled to an order requiring the Attorney General to conduct a preliminary investigation. See FTC versus Anderson, 631 F2D 741. 750, D.C. Circuit, 1979. Accordingly, it is hereby ordered that plaintiff's motion for summary judgment is granted. So, in the horrible 80s, in Dellums versus French Smith, the mayor who would do the same thing in the Chauncey Bailey and Oscar Grant assassinations by the police, used his authority as a mayor to trump everybody else and act with the strength of a federal official in a municipal role, really. But no, I mean, just with the strength of a sovereign individual, not intimidated, because he went to the police and told the OPD, listen, you're going to tell your BART colleagues, you know, to step aside, then you're going to, you know, cuff Messerly. And for the first time in the state of California's history, Pig went to jail for murdering one of us. Anyway, that was the mayor who was, and like unlike any other mayor we have ever had, unlike any other armed services chair we have ever had.
Some people have said, well, don't you believe that this would inconvenience the president? The Constitution is designed to inconvenience one person from taking us to war. War is a very, very solemn and sobering and extraordinary act, and it should not be granted to one person.
But it is granted to one person. Oh, goddamn. Now I gotta go all the way back to the beginning. So he was on the streets. And I was just talking about
telling the Oakland PD they had to do their job, regardless if they had to throw down against their armed colleagues in the BART police. But, oh yes, so here he is on the streets as the cop cars are burning. There's the mayor. The mayor is on the streets amid the burning cop cars after, it was like within a week or so of Oscar Grant's murder. And, oh yes, that's the right one. It's a big old file. And it starts with, oh, it starts with this. Well, I gotta put the mic up here, but.
Haitian Muckleberg, why is there no share button on my Ron Dellums versus Laura Nicaragua post? That's what people are telling me, Haitian Muckleberg.
Congressmember Ron Dellums opposed bloated military spending throughout his career, instead pushing for increased investment in housing, health care, and education. Lee, who remains a leading anti-war voice in the House. After serving in Congress, Ron Dellums served one term as mayor of Oakland. What were you proudest of and accomplishing on the Armed Service Committee as the chair?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was at the chair, but one of the things we did, John Kasich, who is now the governor of Ohio, he asked me one day, he said, Ron, why do you oppose the MX missile? No, the B-2 bomber. He said, why do you oppose the B-2 bomber? And I looked at him, I said, you really want to know? He said, yeah. I said, we can't afford it. We don't need it. We can't afford it. And there are alternatives. And he said, explain. So I explained it to him. He said, I like that. So he came back to me a few days later and said, I would be honored to co-sponsor on a bipartisan basis an amendment to stop the B-2 bomber, the Dellums-Kasich Amendment. We did something nobody's done in modern history. We stopped a major weapon system on a bipartisan basis with this guy and myself. And I thought that that was a very significant thing. Other than that, eventually winning the day to see Nelson Mandela freed and to see him sworn in as president of South Africa and having played some small role in extending the civil rights movement, the peace movement, into challenging oppression in another country and helping that day come was also a great honor for me.
How did you do that? What was the legislation you passed around Nelson Mandela and apartheid South Africa?
Okay. Little known history. The Congressional Black Caucus organized in 1971. Late 1971, we were meeting. I think we used to meet on Tuesday or Wednesday. And a note got passed in to the CBC meeting. And we had a very significant agenda. And somebody said, there's a militant group of black folks from New England who are demanding, you know, we used to talk like that back in the day, demanding a meeting with the Congressional Black Caucus. And so everybody looked and said, man, we have this ambitious agenda. And so they looked at me. I'm from the Bay Area, right? So dealing with radicals and militants, they said, well, send Ron to the meeting. Would you be willing to go? So I said, of course, I'd be happy to go. And John Conyers of Michigan said, I will go with him. So we go out. Turns out this group of people were a group of workers from New England who worked for Polaroid Corporation.
In Massachusetts.
Polaroid Corporation, Polaroid pictures were the pictures that blacks had to present when challenged in South Africa. So these folks came because they were uncomfortable working for a corporation that was doing business in South Africa. And they brought a petition and they wanted a pledge that somebody would work on a piece of legislation that would bring economic disinvestment. And I stood up in that meeting and I shook their hand and I said, I would be honored to be your instrument, having no idea that that was going to be nearly a 16-year commitment, day in and day out, okay? And eventually, by a strange set of circumstances, which you don't have time to go into, the House of Representatives actually passed the disinvestment bill, which then forced the Republican-controlled Senate to go further than they would have gone. And we ended up, by an even stranger set of circumstances, getting the Republicans to agree to override Reagan's veto. Because I had the right to go to conference because the House passed my version of the bill. And the Republicans passed their version of it wasn't disinvestment, it was a sanction bill. So they called a big meeting and they said, Ron, we know you have the right to go to conference with the Senate to fight for a stronger bill. But Reagan said he's going to veto. And if one word of this bill gets changed, we cannot guarantee that we could override the veto. So At a certain point, I stood up and I said, I respect everyone in this room. This is not about Ron Dellums. This is about South Africa. And if by my actions to assert my prerogatives and we fight to change the bill and Reagan vetoes it, the word that will go around the world is the United States does not override the veto. That would set us back. So I said, I will respectfully step back, and I withdrew my bill. And a lot of people don't know that. And allowed the Republican bill to come to the House. They passed it.
And what was it? What was the difference? And what was the
Well, it was a sanction bill. Okay. It was, you know, it wasn't the strongest bill, but it was veto proof. And I heard everyone in that room, and I said, this is not about me, it's not about my ego, not about my pride. This is about South Africa. Okay. And I felt that if the word went out, Senate override Reagan veto, that would far exceed even the dimensions of the bill. It turns out that was right, because the word that went around the world was Congress stands up against Reagan's veto and overrides the veto, and it took on a significance all on its own. So being a progressive guy, our thought is keep introducing, you know, the center is not a static place. The center is based on who shows up for the fight. So the left had to keep showing up. So I kept bringing the bill back. Finally, 2 years later, the Dellums bill actually became the instrument that passed the House on a record vote, not a voice vote. A German journalist came to see us when I was chair of Armed Services, and he told this story. He said his research indicated that F. Edward de Klerk called Margaret Thatcher and said, what do you think I ought to do? To which, according to his research, Margaret Thatcher said, the Dellums bill passed in 1986 on a fluke, but it passed again 2 years later on a record vote. The Democrats now control the Senate. It's going to pass the Senate, and it's going to become law. To which he said, so what should I do? Her response was, free Mandela and begin a process of negotiating a new South Africa. So on the way out the door, this journalist said, tell your boss that while his bill never became law, it hung over South Africa like the sword of Damocles. I was proud of that.
Last question. When did you first meet Nelson Mandela? Can you describe that moment?
Never forget it. Mandela leaves South Africa, and he goes to Lusaka, Zambia, where the ANC were meeting.
What year?
1990.
Yeah, when he was freed. Okay. So that morning, I get up, and I'm like, wow, man, I'm standing in line, I'm going to meet Nelson Mandela. Never in my wildest imagination did I ever think I would ever lay eyes on this man, let alone to see him in person. And I had gone all over the country, free Mandela, free my people, free South Africa. Never thought I'd ever see Mandela. So I get up right there, and Bill Gray, one of my former colleagues in the Black Caucus from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, he says, Mr. Mandela, I would like you to meet Congressman Dellums. And Mandela did this Hollywood double take. And he has these big hands, because remember, he wanted to be a heavyweight prize fighter. And this is my impression of Mandela. And he heard my name, and he goes, Ronald Dellums, we have heard much of you. You gave us hope. You kept us alive. And he hugged me, and I broke down and cried. I broke down and cried, and my kid said, Pop, you actually met Mandela. What did you think? And I said, I think that I've been in the presence of the strongest, most serene human being I've ever encountered in my entire life. Kid said, "Pop, you've actually met Mandela. What did you think?" And I said, "I think that I've been in the presence of the strongest, most serene human being I've ever encountered in my entire life. And I never had any cause to alter that assessment of him. He was an incredible person." And whenever he, you know, whenever he would see me, he would say, "My dear friend Ronald," and my heart would explode. And, Remember when he came to the United States on his thank you tour? In Oakland, you know, I mean, competing with San Francisco or L.A., you know. Everybody was competing for his time. But Mandela on his own said, "Before I leave this country, I'm going to Oakland to thank Ron Dellum's constituency for his service and for their support." 55,000 people showed up. And a lot of people had no sense that the Bay Area is the second most diverse area in the country. So Mandela walks out on the stage with me. And
where was this? Candles? The stadium?
No, this was in Oakland, the Oakland Coliseum. So, I mean, I'm walking out. Mandela's in my hood, right? So I'm walking out. The place is packed, 55,000 people. And Mandela looks out and he sees this incredible sea of humanity. And he turned to me, and this was the second thing I'll never forget. He said, "Now I better understand you. You represent the human family. You represent where we must go. You represent the future of South Africa." And what he was saying to me was that in that moment, he saw a young black man who represented the entire human family. And he said, My vision is not just a dream. It can be real because this guy's living it." And it brought us closer to each other because he saw that. And when he said to me, "You represent where we must go," I mean, what can I say?
What can Congress do around the issue of police killings all over this country? What role do you think Congress can play? Since you're talking about local police forces, you can work locally. What about federally, nationally?
Remember, I talked to you locally about a model policy on the use of deadly force that people ought to take to every different community, exercise your citizenship muscles, engage with cities around a universal model policy on the use of deadly force based on people being equal lives, people equal protection. Okay, so at the federal, so if you're dealing with that and policing is a local thing, dealing with that at the federal level, we keep acting as if we're reinventing the wheel. So Baltimore explodes and they go, "Oh my God, what's wrong?" The same damn thing that was wrong 20 years ago, 30 years ago, poverty, hunger, disease, inadequate education, all right, homelessness, hopelessness, okay, neglect. So it's not, you know, reinventing the wheel. Congress, get off your duff and start dealing with the real problems that confront America. Poverty's on the rise in this country. And we need to deal with that, okay? So Congress can step up. I'm one of the people that don't believe, that challenges the notion that conservatives have that the poverty program was a big failure. The poverty program was brilliantly conceived, and it was being brilliantly implemented. For the first time in American history, poor people actually could direct millions of dollars. And number two, poor people actually started organizing. And we were the Young Turks in the community. And we actually said, when Washington figures out that they're financing a revolution, they're going to end this thing. And I said, so we need to organize folks in the community so that when the money dries up, they're still organized to go forward. So we actually saw it. And that's what happened. Poor people had lawyers. Poor people had money. Poor people had doctors and health providers. And, you know, we were the generation that poor people in the community sent to college. They were the folks from the South. So they sent us to school. We came back, lawyers, teachers, social workers, architects, and what have you. So when the war on poverty came, we were the ones in the back room writing new ideas and new policies, okay? Washington saw that, and they said, man, we got to end this. So then they start calling it poverty pimps, welfare pimps, blah, blah, blah. So they killed the idea, and we never were able to remount the idea because people never fought hard enough to defend the idea that the poverty program was a brilliantly conceived set of ideas that really addressed a number of institutional problems that still manifest themselves, okay? So we've got to figure out how to get that energy back out there. And my message to young people is, you got to stand up and fight back. And they said, well, are there two things that we could do? If you could only do two things to strike at poverty, what would you do? And I said, first, I would deal with gender equity in the workplace. I said, because if you make sure that women make the same amount of money that men make in the working place, you will strike a blow at poverty that would be so amazing when you see all these single family homes and blah, blah, blah. So number one, gender equity, you know, in terms of income. Mm-hmm. Number two is we need to stop the conversation about minimum wage. I think that's an antiquated concept. And maybe I'm an old guy, but my point is, minimum what? We ought to be talking about livable wage, okay? So if you do those two things, it's interesting. When you confront conservatives on livable wage, they don't quite know how to respond. But the point being, well, look, you guys don't want government to subsidize helping folks.
Yeah, right. We believe in no taxes and little government.
Okay. So then why don't you support my right to be able to take care of myself by being able to have a livable wage? You can't walk both sides of the street simultaneously. Mm-hmm. You can't say you don't want me to be able to do it on my own and you don't want to help me. So I think engaging with this generation of young people is awesome. And I come home from those engagements, and I feel, you know, the passion, the blood's running warm. You know what I mean? I'm alive, and I'm young. And so I think trying to engage this generation of young people and helping them understand the lessons, you know. And Martin Luther King said, remember he said that longevity has its place. I would like to live a long life. Well, for whatever reason, I've been blessed with longevity. I'm damn near 80. So part of that longevity is how do I convey those lessons learned? Not by being a dinosaur of yesterday, but to use the lessons of yesterday to bring them forward. And so I think that's the fun part. Being the mayor was an awesome, difficult job. Being the chair of the Armed Services Committee was perhaps the most incredible time in my life because I got up one morning and the peacenik from Berkeley was chairing the Armed Services Committee. And it was the greatest, one of the great challenges of my life. But being the mayor, you live with it intimately on the ground, day in and day out. There's no hiding. There's no, you got to have the resource in order to be able to do it. So each and every one of them were challenges. And I keep saying to myself, what are you going to do when you grow up? And I keep thinking, I'm going to go back to being a social worker.
Former Congressmember, former Oakland Mayor Ron Dellum speaking in two.
What's going on? And when I listen to the BBC, I can't even watch the BBC now because you have people sitting there and talking matter of fact, like, oh, the Novichok, that was made in Russia.
Yeah.
There's no evidence whatsoever for any of this nonsense.
First off, they're talking about Scripple BZ. It's quinucleodienyl benzylate. It's a muscarinic acetylcholine receptor antagonist, which is the opposite of acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Of course, anybody thinks about the vegetative system being jammed in the on position, that's what pesticides do, because it's going to slow you down, your heartbeat and breathing to death, okay? Now, a receptor antagonist is going to block it, just like caffeine is an adenosine receptor antagonist because it sits in the little block, a little hole, and instead of the waste product from ATP telling you it's time to go recharge your phosphates on the adenosine molecule, it's telling you that, the receptor is blocked, so your vegetative system can't function, which is why it's the antidote to these things that are the acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. Anyway, get it straight, guys. Important damn bit of this crap, Christ's sake. Or their Nazi, the Yankee, skanky Yankee spawn, of the misbegotten spawn of the slime buckets up the Thames. Both the Pirates of the Thames and the Potomac were funding Hitler through Prescott Bush's Union Bank. Okay, $50 million. During the Depression, building trucks in Germany, Ford trucks during the Depression, and then you're going to say, oh, we got to go, no, go east if you want to stop Hitler. That's where the fat stalker lies.
And the media...